Hey, you're listening to the Words on Flick show with me, Janine Coveney. You're listening to the Words on Flick show on eWater Radio, KEWR-DB.
The views and comments expressed do not reflect the opinions of eWater Radio. All comments and views are show guest views and comments and in no way reflect views or comments of eWater Radio, KEWR-DB, or its affiliates.
Hey there, Words on Flicks fans. Thanks for tuning in. Happy Palm Sunday. We're running a week early because next week is Easter. So today's episode is location, 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 New York City in the movies. And I'm so happy to have my longtime friend and colleague, notable cultural scribe Michael A. Gonzalez, in for a wide-ranging chat about the flicks that we love that represent our hometown. So I hope you enjoy. You can find out more about Michael and his background and his many accomplishments in the webpage for this show. Read it, check it out. You can also read some of his many articles at crimereads.com. And of course, my movie reviews are at wordsonflicks.blogspot.com. So sit back, relax, get ready to laugh and enjoy. Michael Gonzalez.
Hey, Janine. How are you?
I am well. How are you doing this fine April evening?
Well, I've been looking forward to this conversation all day so we could go back into the cinematic time machine that is New York movies.
Exactly, exactly. So you're like the perfect person for me to do this with because you're a New York native. I'm a New York native. We both love the city and its craziness, its beauty, its ugliness, its cultural and social history. And there have been so many movies made in New York about New York. New York is as much a center of filmmaking as Hollywood ever was. So we both were tasked with picking some of our favorite movies about New York. And I know you've got your list and I've got my list, and, you know, the list could go on forever, right?
Well, that's the thing about making lists like this. It's like, you know, I pick some of my favorite movies, but I still have so many more favorite movies that could have been a part of the list as well.
I don't know. We may have to do a part two at some point because as I'm looking at the movies that I want to talk about, like most of them, well, you know, I love old movies. We both love old movies. And there were so many contemporary movies or more contemporary movies that are made in and about New York. I think my list might stop around, you know, the 1980s. I don't think I have anything from the 1990s or above in my list.
Well, I mean, and that was the thing. I mean, because even like recently I was looking at clips. I was writing about Harlem and, you know, I always consider Barry Michael Cooper, who's one of my favorite screenwriters, and he's written, you know, what I call the Harlem trilogy, New Jack City, Above the Rim, and Sugar Hill. And Sugar Hill is one of my favorite movies. And, you know, when we were making the list yesterday, I'm like, oh, man, I'm not going to have time for Sugar Hill.
I know. I love that movie, too, Sugar Hill. I think I even like it better than New Jack City, but, you know.
It's a much more realistic movie than New Jack City. I mean, it's kind of funny because looking at New Jack City years later, as much as I like it, it's still somewhat of a fantasy cartoon in comparison to what Sugar Hill was. I mean, Sugar Hill was just gritty.
Yeah, exactly. Crime in Harlem and brother against brother, right?
Exactly. Brother against brother and the junkie father and all of that. But we're getting off. We're getting off our. We're already on a tangent
So this is the way I thought this would go, and hopefully this will work out. We'll probably have to cut off before we even get to half our list. But as I said, I asked you to come up with some New York titles, and I came up with some New York titles. So I figured that we would take turns introducing a title, and you would talk to me about the specifics about the movie and just what about it is so quintessentially New York, whether it's the locations, the people, the story, whatever it is that makes you connect it to New York. So you being my illustrious guest, I will give you the first movie choice.
Well, I'm not even sure if you've ever seen this movie, but the first movie on my list was The Anderson Tape. And even though I saw The Anderson Tapes when I was younger, I believe it came out in 71. I saw The Anderson Tapes probably when I was like 8 or 9 years old. But the thing of it is, it always stayed with me. It was, as a kid, it was the first Sean Connery movie I had ever seen that wasn't a Bond.
Wow.
And it was also Christopher Walken's first movie. And it's just such a New York movie. I mean, they shoot all over town. But it was also directed by Sidney Lumet. And Sidney Lumet, to me, is one of those quintessential New York directors. I mean, this is the guy who later on would make Serpico, who made Dog Day Afternoon, who made Prince of the City, who made Q&A, you know, all these fantastic New York movies. And, you know, I believe he's a New Yorker as well. I think he came from the Lower East Side. But the thing about The Anderson Tapes also was that it was a heist movie. It takes place on the Upper West Side. I'm not sure exactly what building it is, but it's almost like it's like the Dakota kind of building. And these guys, you know, led by Sean Connery, decided that they're going to rob the entire building over like Labor Day weekend. But, you know, when they're setting up the whole heist, Sean Connery's character is going all over New York. He goes up to Harlem where he gets this ex-Black Panther guy. I mean, he's also fresh out of prison, so he's getting a lot of guys that he knew from prison. So he goes up to Harlem to get a guy. He goes to the Lower East Side to get a guy. I mean, it's like the movie, even though it takes place mostly on the Upper West Side, it shows you all sides of New York. And, you know, Lumet just had such a feel for the city. I mean, from everybody, from the thieves to the florists to the cops. I mean, it's just that kind of movie, you know?
Absolutely. And you said you don't know if I've seen it. I've seen this movie multiple times. I love it, too. I love this movie with a passion, and because it is Sean Connery, and it is, I think, I don't know if it's the first movie I've seen when he's not Bond, but my impression was that it was on the Upper East Side on Fifth Avenue, but who cares? It's right next to Central Park. It's like one of those huge, rich, really extravagant buildings where rich people live. And, you know, it's got Diane Cannon, who's so fabulous. And I can't even think of the other actor's name who plays this gay designer.
Martin Balsam.
Yes.
Dick Anthony Williams is also in it. Dick Anthony Williams plays the Black Panther character that he goes to get. And it's kind of funny because Lumet went back to use Dick Anthony Williams a year later when he played one of the FBI guys in Dog Day Afternoon. Yes. And I don't know if you remember also, but two things that we should point out that I forgot to point out in the beginning. It also has an amazing Quincy Jones soundtrack, which is, like, to me, like, all heist movie comes from the stuff that Quincy was doing in the 60s and in the 70s, you know, and that soundtrack, I'm not even sure if it's ever been released officially. I've listened to it a few times on YouTube. And then also, before he became a member of Saturday Night Live, Gary Morris is also in it playing one of the cops.
Yes, he is. That's right. It's a fabulous movie. It's quintessentially New York, and it's a wonderful movie.
I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a heist movie where people actually get away with it. So, like, we come in kind of knowing the heist is not going to be as smooth as as they want it to be. You know what I mean? But, like, up until the end of the movie, we're like, You're like, these guys are going to get away. I'm just cheering for these guys. And every time I see it, it gives me, like, the anticipation. You know, like, that scene when it's really quiet, but the street is actually filled with, like, 50 cops, you know?
Yeah.
I just love that scene.
Absolutely. And so for those who haven't seen it, you know, the gist of it, which is what I was getting to, the Anderson tapes, is the fact that here is Connery gotten out of jail and has not kept up with the technology such as it was in the 1970s. But now wiretapping and surveillance has become so much more advanced that the whole building is wired for sound and ultimately helps get them caught.
Well, not just the building, but everything. I mean, the Black Panther office is bugged. I think, wasn't the first place bugged, too? Like, they're listening from different sides. It's like, and it's not just one agency. It's like the FBI is listening in, the CIA, the IRS, whoever. Like, all these different bugs basically leading to this one man.
Exactly. And so that's kind of like the other side of the movie, just to deal with this technology. So I think we've nailed the Anderson tapes, and there is a lot of information on YouTube where you can learn more about it. So it's so funny. We like so many of the same things. My movie choice for the next movie is The Sweet Smell of Success, which came out in 1957. It's a shiny black and white movie of its time, the 1950s. It's got Tony Curtis, Burt Lancaster. I think this is like one of the best roles he's ever done, really. And I've seen a few Tony Curtis things. It's centered in the theatrical world of Manhattan. And Tony Curtis is a press agent. And he feels that he is beholden to Burt Lancaster, who plays this Walter Winchell type newspaper columnist who can make or break an act or any other personality by what he says in his column about them. So Tony has some theatrical clients and he's trying to get them into Burt Lancaster's column, but Burt Lancaster is kind of holding the column hostage until Tony Curtis does some underhanded favors for him. So it's like dirty New York of the 1950s. And I love it so much because not only of the story, but you see like backstage in the theater district, you get to see the great white way of Broadway all lit up in, you know, in black and white glory. And the jazz clubs of 52nd Street and those classic New York City hangouts like Sardi's and 21 during the era when all of that became famous and, you know, people got dressed up for cocktails and women had their gloves and their hats and the music was jazz and the Chico Hamilton Quintet appears in the movie and the dialogue is just unequal. The dialogue is so quick and snappy and multi-leveled, and I can never get enough of this movie. I just love it. What do you think of it?
I love it, too. I mean, the thing about The Sweet Smell of Success is that it's multiple genres. I mean, I've always looked at it as almost like a noir film, you know, and I know a lot of people think of noir as crime and cops and robbers and everything, but, you know, noir basically is dark fiction, and there's nothing darker than this movie. I mean, it's almost the flip side of the shiny Runyon tales, which all takes place in Times Square as well. So it's like, you know, where you see like the technicolor of Guys and Dolls, this is like this stark black and white of New York City in a, you know, just the same area, but in a different way. It's also the golden age of newspapers and the golden age of the newspaper columnists when people like that actually had a lot of power. I mean, that's like, you know, if today, if TMZ or Page Six could actually affect somebody's career to the point where they could get them kicked out of the business or they could, you know, make them into a communist or whatever.
At one point, Tony Curtis plants marijuana on this young guitarist that he's trying to get rid of.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing too, because, you know, you and I haven't been on the, you know, reporters or writers having to deal with publicists. This movie makes publicity look very dirty. I mean, like, Tony Curtis's character will do anything for Burt Lancaster to get a line or two into this story. And the way Burt Lancaster, who, I might add, was also one of the producers. Burt Lancaster started producing, I guess, in the late 40s, and this was one of his movies as well. But the thing of it is, Burt Lancaster's character, he is so scary. I mean, you know, you look at him, and Burt Lancaster, first of all, he's not a little guy, you know, so he's already towering and, you know, bulging, and he just comes across as such a scary person, and he's so cold-blooded. I mean, and the thing with Burt Lancaster, who I think is a fantastic actor. You know, we've seen him be vulnerable. We've seen him be sad, you know, but this character, you're just like, oh my God, I hope I never come across anybody like this man.
Match me, Sydney. Not right now.
I mean, that's the thing, too, about, you know, these movies that always kind of crack me up, where everything is to excess. Man, I think we could talk about the plot, because if people haven't seen The Sweet Smell of Success by now, I don't know what's keeping them. But, you know, when he decides that he doesn't want his sister with this guy anymore, it's like he can't just, like, you know, move his sister somewhere else or send her to boarding school or whatever. He has to destroy this guy. And it becomes, like, this focused mission to, like, you know, this guy has to be thrown in jail. And it's just so, it's almost crazy how, you know, much tunnel vision that character has.
Exactly. It is vicious. But Tony Curtis is just as vicious, because I think when I saw the movie, I was like, oh man, Tony Curtis is scuttling around and doing all this dirty stuff. But to me, the dirtiest thing he did was when the waitress was asking him for help, and he basically pimped her out. And I'm thinking, oh my God, how horrible. He sets her up with a competing columnist in his apartment and says, hey, to this woman, entertain this guy and I'll help you keep your job or whatever it was. And so this competing columnist is a married man. He's thinking he's going to get a night of whoopee. And I'm thinking, oh my God, how horrible. And then you find out that the girl's done it before. She ain't new to that. You know, she's not being totally turned out in the street. She's done it before. So this movie has so many great twists and turns, and it looks great. It, you know, it looks shiny. You know, it black and white can take many, many forms, but this, there's a lot of night scenes and a lot of indoor scenes, and it's just kind of immaculate and crisp looking, and I love it.
Well, you know, the cinematographer was James Wong Howe, who worked on so many movies. I'm surprised nobody's done a documentary about him, because I remember seeing his name and being like, wow, there's Asian people behind the camera. And he was the only one. I mean, he shot so many movies that we know of, from The Sweet Smell of Success, The Second, Funny Lady. I'm reading off of his thing right now. Mm-hmm. But he was the one that made New York look like that. And that's the thing a lot of times with these cinematographers, is that they get left out of the equation when people start talking about how the movies look. And I think that's a perfect way for me to get into talking about Manhattan, because even though it's a Woody Allen movie, it's also shot in black and white, and the cinematographer on that movie was Gordon Willis. And Gordon mm-hmm. Willis, who had shot, you know, the Godfather movies, he's, you know, worked with so many different directors, but a lot of times the cinematographers, you know, they're not even part of the conversation anymore. And they work hand in hand with the directors in developing what the movies are going to look like.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. So Manhattan.
Chapter 1. He adored New York City. He idolized it all out of proportion. He romanticized it all out of proportion. Better. To him, no matter what the season was, this was still a town that existed in black and white and pulsated to the great tunes of George Gershwin. Now, let me start this over. Chapter 1. He was as tough and romantic as the city he loved. Behind his black-rimmed glasses was the coiled sexual power of a jungle cat. Oh, I love this. New York was his town, and it always would be.
Manhattan. Okay, I saw Manhattan when I was younger, and when I was literally a kid. I can't remember what year it came out, but I was probably like 15, 16 when it came out. And it's kind of funny because as much as I love New York movies, as we were talking about the other day, during the 70s, there were two kinds of New York movies. There were the uptown gangster movies or the vigilante Death Wish movies, or there were Woody Allen movies. And even though they took place in the same New York, it might as well have been two different worlds. I loved Annie Hall, and I remember seeing Annie Hall at the Olympia Theater, which was a theater on 107th Street in Broadway. And that might have been the same place where I saw Manhattan. I either saw Manhattan at the Olympia or at the Playboy, which was on 34th Street and off of 2nd Avenue. But Manhattan was one of those movies that kind of made me aspire to what I would eventually do. You know, I wanted to be part of that literary scene. I wanted to write for literary magazines. I wanted to have friends who were writers and had smart conversations in cafes. And, you know, I wanted to go to Elaine's, and I wanted to be part of that. Some of it I blame on my mother, because my mother used to bring home, like, Interview Magazine and Q Magazine and New York Magazine, and, you know, all these different things that made me think outside of 151st Street and Broadway, where I was living. And even though I was too young to go to bars or even restaurants by myself, watching those movies, you know, I was able to kind of transport myself into those worlds. I loved Manhattan because it just looked so good. And Woody Allen, you know, the whole thing is this guy who's a writer who basically quits his television job to try to write his first novel. So he has to downsize, you know, he has to move out of his luxury apartment into a more affordable apartment. And, you know, he's doing everything but writing his novel. I mean, it's this whole thing with procrastination. Now, this movie gets a bad rap as well because, you know, in the movie, he has two romances, and one of them is with the Diane Keaton character, and the other one is with this young girl, Muriel Hemingway. At the time, she was probably the age I was when I saw it. She was like 16 or 17. She is in high school, and she's a senior in high school, if that makes a difference. And he's dating her. And the funny thing about her character is she's almost the most mature character in the movie. And it's kind of sad. You have all these people who are in their 40s who are just so confused. I mean, even like his friend, because basically his friend is having an affair verse. His friend, who's played by Michael Murphy. I mean, it always kind of cracks me up with the Woody Allen friends, because they're always like, it's like another side of him. You know, it's almost like his twin who's been split or whatever. His name is Yale, and he's a literature professor, Eddie, because that's when Woody Allen goes to see his wife at the inn, and that's when he decides that he's going to go back to Tracy.
Like 1979, I had basically come out of high school at that point, and I was already in college. I mean, it was strange to see a young girl dating this older man in the movie, and nobody said beans about it, you know.
When we were that age, I knew girls who were dating older men, who were dating teachers and, you know, having these affairs with grown men, and
But that's
I always thought it was kind of weird, but I don't remember anybody ever commenting on it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I went to an all-girls high school that was smack in the middle of Manhattan, and a lot of my classmates were having affairs with older men to the point where businessmen would be lining up in the lobby, you know, to pick up their sweethearts, you know, when they got out of school. So, but anyway, right. The other thing about Woody Allen, who he's the quintessential New York Jewish intellectual filmmaker, and he had a lot of influence on me as well through his movies. And I loved Annie Hall as well. And of course, he gets a bad rap now, but he had a whole, you know, a whole pantheon of movies that were so quintessentially New York. Pretty much all of his movies are about him being in love with somebody and then deciding he's not in love with that person because he wants to be with somebody else. That, you know, every movie is him. I'm in this relationship, but I don't want to be in this relationship. I want to be in another relationship, and now I'm in the other relationship. Now I want to go back to the first relationship. It's like all this indecision. It is the better deal theory that there's always someone better around the corner. You know, you're always thinking that you can trade up, but that's so mercenary. I'm not saying it's a good attitude to have. You know, I'm talking about teenage years and early adult years seeing these movies and just being like, oh, my God. Woody Allen and you know, Hannah and her sisters and all of that. But we could have a whole show about Woody Allen movies, let me tell you.
Well, let me say one thing about Manhattan. Manhattan was one of the movies that I had three movie posters on my wall when I was a kid. One of them was King Kong, the remake, the one on the Twin Towers. One of them was Manhattan, and then a couple years later, it was Stranger Than Paradise. But one of the things that I loved about Manhattan, that it was also my introduction to George Gershwin. And they play Rhapsody in Blue and other Gershwin songs throughout. I never heard of George Gershwin. I mean, look, I was like, I don't know, 14, 15 years old, something like that. I had never heard of George Gershwin. I didn't even know who George Gershwin was. So, like, hearing Rhapsody in Blue, I remember going to the store to buy the Manhattan soundtrack. And that, like I said, that was my introduction to that whole period of music. Like, later on, I was not just into Gershwin, but, you know, Duke Ellington and, you know, all these kind of big band people from that day. I mean, I love that music. And so for me, Woody Allen was kind of an introduction to that. I mean, one of the movies, I think Hannah and her sisters, there was a scene where they went to the Carlisle and you see Bobby Short playing. And,
right. Yeah, they go to the Carlisle and see Bobby Short and have an argument over her snorting cocaine at the table. But,
wasn't there also a scene with the younger sister when they go to CBGB's or something like that?
Yeah, that's also with the same sister. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Same night. She says, I love songs about extraterrestrials, don't you? He says, not when they're played by extraterrestrials. and then the date ends badly, and he's like, you don't deserve Bobby Shore. You don't deserve Cole Porter, you know, because you acted so badly. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I remember in that movie that I really liked, and I can't remember who he was in the cab with, but he was like, oh, you know, I must really like you because I'm looking at you more than I'm looking at the meter.
That's a quintessential New York idea.
Oh, man.
Oh, God. Can we move on?
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. Thank you for that. I enjoyed that talk about Manhattan. And speaking of Manhattan, I'm going to get into a musical, In Color, 1961, West Side Story. Now, I know West Side Story has been in the news and in people's consciousness recently because Steven Spielberg decided to remake it. And, you know, I am happy for Ariana DeBose, who won an Oscar for appearing in last year's remake. But let me tell you, I do not really like the remake because the original West Side Story was a thing unto itself. It was exciting. It was colorful. It attempts to tackle the gang problem that Manhattan had, you know, and all of the boroughs had gangs coming up, particularly through the 50s and 60s. You know, gang warfare, turf warfare was a thing. So this is sort of a candified version of, you know, gang issues with a Romeo and Juliet story thrown in. And then, but it was the first movie I'd ever seen that featured Puerto Ricans, like the only movie I'd ever seen that had Puerto Ricans as protagonists in the movie. It's like nobody in America had ever heard of Puerto Ricans, you know, and here they were in this movie and people didn't even understand that Puerto Rico was not a foreign country. It is part of the United States.
People don't understand that today.
They don't understand it today. And so I love this movie. And when I saw it, I was really, really, really young. And I did not internalize the fact that a lot of the people playing the Puerto Ricans were not actually Puerto Rican. I did not internalize any of the maybe ethnic slurs. I understood that these two gangs were adversaries. And I loved the dancing and the color scheme. Like all the Puerto Ricans were in red and purple, and all the whites were in yellow and blue. And it was just a schematic, right? So you're in this neighborhood that's kind of north of Hell's Kitchen, west of Broadway in the 60s, right? And, you know, they ended up raising that area to put up Lincoln Center. And so these people were kind of squashed over there where the West Side Highway replaced the West Side Elevated Highway. So when you see the rumble that they have, the fight where Bernardo and Riff end up getting stabbed, it's under the elevated West Side Highway, which is no more. And some of the trouble that I have with the current West Side Story is the fact that they explain too much. You know what I mean? Like they explain how they were building the Lincoln Center and they try to put all this sociology into it. And then they also open it up to other locations in the city, which I didn't enjoy. Like part of the tension of West Side Story and the Jets and the Sharks is that they're stuffed into this territory that they both think belong to them, these few square blocks that belong to them. And everything that happens in the original West Side Story happens in these few small blocks. But I think in the movie, they're up at the Cloisters, and then they're down at, instead of the dress shop, they're down at Gimbel's on 34th Street. I didn't like the remake. It didn't have the same...
Well, I know they shot a lot of it in Washington Heights, and I didn't know if it was based in Washington Heights or if they just shot it and was trying to call it something else.
Yeah, probably. And a lot of sets. You talking about the remake or the original?
The remake.
Yeah, yeah, yep. But I love it because it's New York. And I know I have some friends who are Puerto Rican who despise the movie, who just feel that it's a horrible representation of who they really are, and they hate the fact that the casting was not really diverse. I mean, you have a Russian-American playing Maria, and, George Shakiris is playing Bernardo, is Greek. So, but I can't help it. I still, when I hear that music, I just melt. I love it.
I never saw West Side Story, the original, until many, many, many years later. I saw it as an adult. And it was kind of funny because my mother loved that movie. But, you know, back in the day before streaming and everything, whenever it did come on television, it always came on in the middle of the night. So I had always seen, like, the first hour, but then I would fall asleep because the movie's, like, what, 3 hours long or something like that? It's a long movie. But then when I finally saw it, I was on assignment in California. I had gone out there. There was a short-lived Essence magazine called Suede, and I went on Suede's dime out to L.A. to interview Eve, and I stayed at this hotel that had cable or whatever, and I finally watched West Side Story, and I was so blown away. And to this day, the Jet song remains one of my favorite songs because I just love the line, from your first cigarette to your last dying day. Like, I always just thought that was like the coolest line ever. I don't have a lot to say about the movie other than the fact that I did like it, but I will share a little side story of one night I was at a party, and there was a television producer that was a friend of a friend, and my friend had taken me to this party, and the guy whose house it was, he was one of the writers or producers for this show that came on HBO called Oz. And anybody who's seen Oz, you know, it was about people in prison. Rita Moreno, who's one of the stars of the original West Side Story, was part of the cast of Oz.
She played a nun.
Yes, she played a nun. Well, when I went outside to smoke a cigarette, the only other person who was outside was Rita Moreno. And she was just so sweet, and she and I talked. I didn't bring up West Side Story. We were just having like some little chit chat. Now this happened in 2000, so it's been 22 years since it happened, but I will just always remember being outside with her and just like being in her space, because I love her, and to this day I love her.
That's sweet. Thank you for sharing that. So what's next on your list?
Spike Lee's Crooklyn, which I will have to say, the first time I saw Crooklyn, I did not like it. I went to a screening of it one day. There used to be a screening room, I think it was 666 Fifth Avenue, like the devil address, right? And I went to see this movie, and I did not like it when I first saw it. I don't know why. Like, I see it now, and I love this movie. And I don't know, maybe I just had my own idea of what I thought the movie would be, because, you know, it's a movie that is nostalgic for an era that I actually grew up in. You know, when I saw the movie, I don't know, maybe I was just having a bad day. But, you know, let's forget all that. I love this movie so much because it does bring back those memories of growing up in New York City. And, you know, like back in the day, like kids didn't stay in the house. You know, our parents made us go outside. I mean, at least my mother did. You know, we had to go outside because they got tired of us. We all lived in apartments. I mean, at least in Crooklyn, they have a house. But, you know, we lived in an apartment. And, you know, so we were constantly outside with our friends, riding bikes, playing games, playing stickball, playing the dozens, going to the store, maybe having a scary experience every now and then. But this was like life in New York City. And Spike, you know, he has captured New York City to the extent of my favorite New York City directors, like Sidney Lumet, like Woody Allen, like Martin Scorsese. You know, Spike has his niche in New York. I mean, I don't even think, besides School Days, I don't think any of Spike's movies ever take place outside of New York. Oh, and Chi-Rock, right? Other than Chi-Rock and School Days, every Spike Lee movie has taken place in New York City.
Absolutely. And I agree with you wholeheartedly on Crooklyn. I think because of the title Crooklyn, I think, you know, I'm from the Bronx, so my experience is somewhat similar but different. I feel like people in Brooklyn have a totally different cultural experience than people in the Bronx necessarily. I mean, it's similar but slightly different. But I still do love this movie. It's nostalgic, and it does capture that and all the characters and the neighborhood and the things you did as kids and the fact of being sent away during the summer to be with relatives in the South. I didn't have relatives
exactly.
In the South. I had relatives up the East Coast and in Detroit. My sister and I were put on a plane when we were mere children with tags around our necks to fly to Detroit to spend the summer with my aunt. So it's a similar kind of experience, you know?
Well, I mean, I had that. In fact, last year, or year before last, I wrote an essay called Summer Mother, which was about my Aunt Ricky, because my Aunt Ricky, she wasn't my mother's sister, but they grew up together. And she was a few years older than my mom, and she loved us to death. And every summer, up until I turned 15 years old, we went to Aunt Ricky's house for the summer. And it was just such an adventure. We loved it. And, you know, we had a house for the first time, because we lived, like I said, we lived in an apartment. We had a house. You know, there was a garden on the side of the house. There was a swimming pool in the backyard. Like, we loved that place. You know, we would go, there was woods on one side, so we would go in the woods and everything. And I mean, like, you know, when Spike made that a part of that experience. I mean, and the thing about Crookman, too, is that Spike has done some collaborations over the years in terms of screenwriters. And that screenplay was co-written with his brother and his sister, with Sinke and Dwa. So they all contribute to, you know, the vision of that movie. And the movie, you know, I don't know if Spike did this because, you know, people were saying that he was sexist or that some of the scripts were misogynistic or whatever, but the story is told from this little girl's point of view. So we're seeing, you know, even though she has all these badass, unruly brothers, she has this sweet mother, a loving father, and, you know, but we see the world through her eyes. And it's almost like, you know, we're experiencing things that she's experiencing for the first time. Whether it's like, you know, that weird sequence in the store, like in the bodega, where doesn't she like dance with RuPaul or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the thing of it is that Spike captured New York before crack. I mean, I look at New York a lot of times as, you know, BC, before crack and after crack. I mean, and, you know, New York had its own, I mean, you know, there were drugs. It wasn't like there were no drugs. I mean, like, there's that whole infamous scene where Spike and the other guy playing the glue sniffers who were, like, sitting on the guy's steps and they're sniffing. I never had that experience. I didn't know any glue sniffers when I was a kid. I mean, maybe that was a Brooklyn thing. I mean, I've heard of people sniffing glue. I just never knew anybody who did.
Me either, honestly.
Yeah, that was probably for the best. But anyway, but you know, I mean, New York during that period was, you know, there was a lot of heroin because there were a lot of Vietnam vets coming back who were strung out. There were a lot of native New Yorkers who never even went to Vietnam who got hooked on drugs and stuff. But it's still, I mean, even though some streets were worse than others, it didn't feel dangerous, you know what I'm saying? And the neighborhood that I grew up in, it seemed very much like what was going on in Crookland, because this was when communities were still communities, when you knew your neighbors and, you know, you could have block parties and everybody works together and, you know, the whole block is like family. And that's how my neighborhood was. I mean, you know, I still talk to friends of mine that I grew up with. And I'm sure, like, I mean, some of those characters that are in that movie, if they survived, they're still talking to each other. I mean, that's something about that movie that I really like, because it shows family, but not just your family who's your blood, but family who's your community.
Absolutely. I grew up in a high-rise building in the Bronx, and it was part of four buildings, and a lot of the neighbors knew each other, and, you know, there were things happening in the building, and we had parkland around, but then across from the parkland, we had open fields. But I think we should move on to the next movie. My next movie is a different kind of movie. It's 3 Days of the Condor from 1935.
Which I just actually seen very recently.
Really? Okay.
I should say seen again very recently. Because, you know, to me, Prime has some of the best streaming old movies than any other channel. I mean, you know, HBO Max as well, but Netflix, not really. Like, when they first started, they had some, you know, like Panic in Needle Park and stuff like that. But some of the best places to find old New York 70s movies on Prime. And I recently, like in the last few months, watched 3 Days of the Condor on Prime.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's a classic. It Robert Redford, Faye Dunaway, Cliff Robertson. And this is like one of my favorite Max von Sydow, however you say his name, roles, because he plays like this hitman named Joubert, and he's very exacting and, you know, he's, oh my God, this movie. And it's directed by Sidney Pollack, who can be considered another kind of great New York director. So you have you have Robert Redford, who's a CIA researcher. He's slaving away in this unassuming looking East Side townhouse. It looks like it's like East 77th Street. You know, it's very genteel and very New York in a row, a street of townhouses of, you know, middle class, well-to-do New Yorkers. And nobody's really supposed to know that in this three floors of this little townhouse is a CIA operation, a research operation where they're really looking for threats and, you know, worldwide threats and things like that. And he does a very New York thing, which is like, hey, I'm going to run out for, you know, lunch. Let me, you want something from the deli? You want something from the corner bodega? Like, I'm going down to Third Avenue or wherever, Lexington Avenue, and you grab something. And while he's out, assassins come in and basically kill everybody in the building, right? So, you know, and so now he knows they're looking for him, and he has to use, I mean, he's like this mild-mannered guy, but he's read so much that he has to use the information that he's learned about in terms of self-defense and deception and, you know, crime to elude the killers who are trying to get this information or squash the uncovering of this information. But in terms of the New Yorkness of it, is that sense of, you know, there's taxi cabs and this genteel street of New Yorkers, and then one of the main locations is the Ansonia Hotel on 72nd Street, which is where he goes to meet what he hopes is a contact who's going to help him, and really they are also trying to gun him down. And you also have scenes at the World Trade Center, and he ends up kidnapping this woman, Faye Dunaway, because he needs her car, and they end up going to her apartment in Brooklyn, and it's a whole big thing. But it is very, you know, you're running around New York and even Washington, D.C. eventually trying to evade killers. So,
well, you know what cracks me up about the movie? And, I love a good heist, a good, intrigue and all thriller. That. But one of the things I want to point out is how unrealistic romances are in some of these films, okay? So, like, he kidnaps her, he, like, basically, like, bogarts into her house, and then they become lovers.
I wrote a review of the movie a couple of years ago, and that's one of the things I put. Like, he ties her to the freaking toilet, you know? While he runs out because he doesn't want her to, you know, to run off. And, they become lovers, like, instant. So they barely know each other's names, you know, but
they barely know each other's names. She has a man. She's supposed to be going away on a ski trip to meet her boyfriend.
Exactly.
And we assume, as handsome as he is, that he must have somebody somewhere. I mean, it's so weird. And maybe I'll say this as an aside. There's another New York movie that I saw, The Hospital, and it has another unrealistic couple, and it's like George C. Scott and Diane Riggs. And George C. Scott's character literally rapes Diane Riggs, and then they become boyfriend and girlfriend. And I'm like, who was writing this stuff back then? I'm like, you know, like, you couldn't get away with that these days. But, like, for real? Like, this is how romances start? I don't think so.
In the 70s they do, because it happened a lot.
The other thing about 3 Days of the Condor that's really good, I mean, you know, you pointed out Sidney Pollack was the director, and I love Sidney Pollack. I mean, Sidney Pollack, he wasn't just a good director, but he was also a funny actor. I mean, he was on Friends. He was, you know, he did guest spots in different places. So, and he also directed Tootsie, which is another, you know, great New York movie. But the thing about these movies back then were also the soundtracks. And David Grusin, who I don't think gets a lot of credit for his stuff. I mean, you know, he's like one of those guys like him and Quincy Jones and David and Burt Bacharach. You know, these guys were great conductors, great composers, but they also did some really good soundtracks. And David Grusin is one of those guys who, you know, he works on a bunch of projects, and then he'll go and produce, like, Angela Beaufield records. You know, the David Grusin soundtrack for that movie is one of my favorite soundtracks. And he did a bunch of soundtracks later on. He did the that I like. He did The Fabulous Baker Boys. He did Heaven Can Wait. But I really, really like what he did on 3 Days of the Condor.
Yeah, and the Tootsie soundtrack is nice, too. So thank you for sharing that. That has nothing to do with the New Yorkness of the movie.
What?
I'm just messing with you, because music really is another important factor. We're both music people as well, so it does play a role. And also, you know, setting the mood and the either the sense of anxiety and even the mood between Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway as they come together. So music is really, really important. So thank you.
You are so welcome. So the next movie, speaking of music, that I have on my list is Claudine. Now, Claudine is one of those movies. I feel like there were movies that came out during the blaxploitation era that had black cast that people try to lump into blaxploitation. You know, whether it's Claudine, whether it's Sparkle, whether it's Cooley High, whether it's Sounder. And these movies really aren't blaxploitation movies. I mean, the thing about Claudine is that, you know, Claudine is basically a domestic tale, literally a domestic tale, of this woman who played by Diane Carroll. It was originally supposed to be played by Diane Sands, but Diane Sands got sick. She had cancer, and Diane Carroll was one of her best friends. And so originally it was supposed to be Diane Sands and Moses Gunn, and then it became Diane Carroll and James Earl Jones. And so, you know, Diane Carroll, we're so used to seeing her play this glam profession. You know, she was one of the first black women on television or the regular series. You know, she was always just very glamorous. And, you know, she's playing like a welfare mother slash maid who's raising these kids, but also trying to have this big romance with her new boyfriend, who's played by James Earl Jones. And I just thought this movie was so good, because we all knew women like that, women who, you know, they worked hard, they had kids that they had to take care of, or the kids were all taking care of each other, and, you know, just trying to survive in that New York world on the day-to-day, keeping your kids out of trouble, you know, keeping food on the table, trying to keep your man happy. I mean, it's like a juggling act. And Diane Carroll pulled it off. I also have to say, you know, I have a story for everything. And this, they shot some of Claudine on my block. The scene where Whoop is taking her to his apartment for the first time is the location is 601 Broadway, which is 151st Street in Broadway. And they shot that scene. Oh, my God. That was the first time I'd ever seen a movie shot. You know, during that era, there were movies shot on the streets of New York all the time. I mean, I saw Serpico get shot. I saw The Eyes of Laura Mars getting shot. But Claudine was the first. And when I saw Diane Carroll, I just kind of lost my mind, and I was like, oh, my God, Diane Carroll, can I get your autograph? And she said, yes. She said, but I have to do something real quick, so I'll be right back, okay? I was like, okay. And I remember standing there waiting for her. She popped in the limo, and then 2 seconds later, she came out. She goes, okay, come over here. And I went over there, and she signed my paper. And so, of course, I've been a Diane Carroll fan for all my life. And I could not wait to see that movie. And every time I see that scene, you know, it's like, you remember that scene where he's taking her to his apartment and the two hookers walk past him? That's that scene. And they must have shot that scene like 30 times, like for real. And I was just like, I don't know what was going on. I don't know if they shot it from different angles, or they had different lines of dialogue, or what. I mean, it took so long, and I just remember, I can't remember what year the movie came out, but the movie was shot a year before it actually came out. So when it came out, I mean, like, there was a movie theater that was down the block from us. That was our regular theater, the Tapia. That's where we saw all the blaxploitation movies and all the karate movies. And all my boys from the block, all my, you know, my play brothers, we all went to see Claudine together. And, you know, I just love that movie. Also, it was shot in Harlem. And the music part of it is that it was a Curtis Mayfield soundtrack sung by Gladys Knight and the Pips. I mean, you can't get no better than that. Curtis Mayfield, even though he was a Chicago boy, did a lot of New York soundtracks. He did the Superfly soundtrack, which was his first, then Claudine, and he also did the soundtrack for Sparkle, which was also a Harlem movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he did these soundtracks for all of these Harlem movies. And the Claudine soundtrack was just so hypnotic. I mean, because in 1970, whatever, who didn't love Gladys Knight, right?
I know. Her voice was perfect. This was 1974 when the film came out. So
okay. I was 11 years old.
She gave so much, like, soul to, you know, I mean, you can't go wrong with Mayfield's music, but she was the voice of Claudine, you know, speaking through the music. Yeah.
That was the thing about Curtis's music with those movies, because it almost seemed like it was an alternative narrative. You know what I mean? Like, and I know Curtis grew up on welfare. I mean, you know, his mother was like Claudine. You know, I mean, Curtis had a bunch of brothers. He grew up on welfare and the projects in Chicago. You know, anybody who watched Good Times knows that it wasn't always peaches and cream in those areas, in Cabrini Green and different places. And that's where Curtis grew up. So I remember interviewing him at one time, and, you know, he said that, you know, even though Superfly is a brilliant soundtrack, Curtis felt like Claudine was a better soundtrack because he knew those characters better.
Well, I've got like 5 more movies.
It's called New York, New York. So that means, you know, it's so good they named it twice. So if this subject is so good, we're going to have to do it twice.
Yeah. Okay, so just tell me right quick. Just tell me the titles. Let's not talk. Just tell me what's left on your list.
What I have left on my list, we actually talked about a little bit, was Superfly. And then the honorable mentions I have is Across 110th Street, The Goodbye Girl, Annie Hall, Sparkle, and Girlfriends.
Ah, love it. Mine are After Hours.
I love After Hours.
Me too. Big. Dog Day Afternoon, which we talked about a little bit, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, and I had some others, but, you know, like Serpico, Breakfast Festivities, Midnight Cowboy, I think was what I put on my list. But you know what? We're going to save it for another time, because I love how you break down the movies and have the backstory and the music, of course. We have to talk about music because we're both music journalists, and so you really brought it 360 degrees. So we're going to have to meet in this space again.
I would love it. Well, you know, I mean, movies is my favorite subject. I mean, I've been watching films since I was a young kid. I mean, the very first, which I didn't put on the list, but my very first movie was Barefoot in Park, Neil Simon, and Robert Redford and Jane Fonda.
Now, that's a New York movie.
My mother said when I was a kid, we used to live in the Lenox Terrace, and she said that I would be walking across the living room and be like, I'm barefooting in the park. I don't have any recollection of any of this, but it's hilarious.
And I forgot Poppy. Remember we were talking about Poppy that one time?
Yeah. Another Puerto Rican not played by a Puerto Rican.
Exactly. So much more to delve into. Thank you so much, Michael Gonzalez, my longtime friend, my brother from another mother. And I'm going to edit this up, and it's going to be a beautiful thing.
Okay. And if anybody wants to read some of my film articles or reviews, they could look at Crime Reads. I've written about some of my favorite New York gangster movies on Crime Reads, so Paid in Full is one of them, and I have a couple of music articles up there, so crimereads.com, and check that out.
Thank you very much.
You are so, so welcome, and I look forward to our next installment.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the Words on Flicks show. I'm Janine Coveney. I'll see you next time. Stay safe out there. Bye-bye.